Scripture and the teaching of Christ Church.
Presta in the Afternoon, weekdays from 4 to 6 on 990 WDEO.
Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
My guest in this hour is Suhail Khan. Suhail has been a friend for many years here in Washington, D.C. He's a Muslim. He's also a lifelong Reagan conservative. He's become, over the years that I've known him, extremely prominent as a spokesman for conservatism, a Muslim spokesman for conservatism, for life, for small government, for free markets. He serves as director of external affairs at the Microsoft Corporation, a member of the Conservative Action Project, and senior fellow at the Institute for Global Engagement, which is a Christian freedom think tank. And because of that, because of his service at the IGE, he's actually been all over the world at conferences in places like Beijing, talking with other people of faith and goodwill about religious freedom. Suhail, welcome to Church and Culture.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Dale.
Now, Suhail, I've known you since you were a young man, and now that you've reached middle age, I'm delighted to have you on the show. And you are, I'll tell my listeners, you're a good-looking young man, knows how to dress well.
Well, thanks, Dale.
Wears pocket linen, which I appreciate. And you've, you know, risen to prominence in the years that I've known you, and deservedly so, I must say. Because you've been through some things. I mean, I asked permission before the show if I could talk to you about this. I mean, over the years, you've been banged around a bit for being a Muslim. How did that feel?
Well, of course, it never feels right, or it's not anything that I welcome or ask for. But over the years, I've come to grow somewhat accustomed to it and to be a little less
hurt.
Angry. Yeah, hurt, a little angry and a little more forgiving. I've really tried to be more forgiving in recent years than I was initially. Initially, a lot of the attacks were not just on me personally, but also on my parents, my late father. And so that, of course, I took very personally.
And the people that have supported you in Washington, like Grover Norquist.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes. So you sort of...
An ongoing struggle. Yep.
You've struggled with it, but you've made as much peace with it as you can, I guess.
That's right. That's right. It's, you know, initially the sting. You know, I born and raised in the United States, I never felt any discrimination well into my adulthood. It was, you know, my faith, the fact that my parents were immigrants from South India. These were never issues negatively. People were curious, and I went to a Catholic school. I was elected to the student body. I was active in undergrad and active in law school, and never felt any issue negatively as an Indian American, as a Muslim American. It was always something that was seen as a curiosity and even positive. I did feel discrimination as a conservative, particularly going to
Cal Berkeley. Yeah, how did you come out of Berkeley a conservative?
Well, I have to give credit to Cal Berkeley for really identifying myself as a conservative. As I said, I went to Catholic school growing up, where, of course, my parents were very concerned about me having a faith-based education. And, I attended church once a week and had Bible study along with my fellow students. Grew up in a conservative household where I was taught to love God and love my country. I went to Cal Berkeley as a 17-year-old freshman, and that was not what I was being taught in the classroom. So I really had to, as the oldest of five children, I really had to take stock of what I believed in when I had professors who were really pushing something that just didn't feel right when it came to...
It's amazing what you'll run into in the academy.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that's when I identified myself as a conservative. Reagan was president, so it was good to have strong leadership in the White House at the helm of our nation. And So I first got involved with the Young Americans for Freedom on campus. I was too young to vote, and then as soon as I turned 18, I registered as a Republican, and the party was very welcoming in California. I got involved in politics not only on campus but with the state party, worked on the first my first campaign was the Bush campaign in 88. And
you ended up serving in the Bush White House.
That's right. That's right. So then I have to...
Well, actually, the latter Bush White House.
Yes,
the son's,
for W.
Yeah.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. So it's it was only after 9/11 that, you know, the fact that I was also a Muslim American became an issue. And
well, stop there for a second.
Absolutely.
I take it that would be true for all Muslims in America. Life kind of changed for them on 9/11.
It changed for all of us, all Americans, including Muslim Americans, absolutely.
And well, how did it, I mean, what were Muslims then looked at as what? Parties to the crime or what?
Exactly. You know, I was just talking to a friend yesterday about this similar issue, and really Muslim Americans found themselves at the intersection of really where two communities in our recent history found themselves, and that was Catholics and Japanese Americans. Catholics, I say, because, as you well know, we've had in our history times where Catholics were seen as suspicious, as seen as a faith that somehow was in conflict with being a loyal American. And at that time, after 9/11, suddenly Muslim Americans were seen as somehow foreign. And even if you were born and raised in this country, even if you had been, by all measures, a loyal American, suddenly your faith was called into question. And then Japanese Americans, because we were associated with those that had attacked us on that fateful morning.
Let me remind our listeners, I'm talking to Suhail Khan, who lives in Washington, D.C. He's well known by many for representing conservative causes, points of view, as a Muslim. And he's been now all around the world at conferences speaking and representing the cause of religious freedom. And I would take it then that 9/11 really created this issue of religious freedom for Muslims that we've now seen in the Ben Carson comment that you addressed very eloquently in an op-ed from a few days ago. Has this been stirring in other places before Ben Carson came out and said that a Muslim should never serve as president of the United States?
Unfortunately so. And the Ben Carson incident, if I can call it that, demonstrates several issues all at once. The first, of course, is what we see just on its face, and that is the question, you know, where do Muslim Americans fit in the American fabric of our society? Where, you know, can they be loyal? Can they serve on a school board? Can they serve in local office, much less can they serve as president of the United States? And those questions are being asked and they're being discussed, sometimes rationally and sometimes not so much. So that's the first issue, and we can talk about that. The other issue that really has not been really discussed in great detail, and you put your finger on it, Deal, is that where are these questions coming from? And why does somebody who's obviously very intelligent, very articulate, as Dr. Ben Carson, why is he saying when he's been asked about this issue, well, I have concerns about a Muslim serving in office because of their beliefs, and then he articulates several beliefs that I as a devout Muslim would very much dispute, that Muslims must dominate society, that they can't live with their Christian and Jewish neighbors, that they have to promote and dominate society with Sharia law. And then even worse, he propagates a long-held myth that Muslims are permitted to lie in furtherance of whatever nefarious goal they may have.
Well, Zuhail, it's well known that Jesuits propagated a doctrine which allowed them to lie in the face of persecution. But
that's right.
I want to mention that I was there yesterday when you very eloquently defended your position when somebody asked you about Sharia law, and you said something I didn't know, and that is, well, that depends on what your interpretation of Sharia law is. That there are various interpretations of Sharia, not just one. I think that's perhaps the most important point you can make to our listeners. Would you explain that?
Sure, absolutely. And it's very complicated, and I'm glad we have the time to talk about it. So first, I should say that at the outset, that the vast majority of Muslim Americans, there are the numbers vary, but usually demographers put it between 6 and 8 million Muslim Americans in the country, like my parents, embraced the Constitution and came to this country, chose to be in this country because they love this country, love the Constitution, and love the freedoms that our Constitution protects and provides for all Americans. Having said that, people of all faiths, generally speaking, would like to govern their own lives, their own personal lives, by the dictates of their religious beliefs. Sharia, for Muslims, is a concept of jurisprudence that is it's a framework. It's not, as I stated before, it's not a book of laws that you pull off the shelf and you begin implementing. There's no one Sharia document. There's no one Sharia code, as it were. Sharia is a very interpretive tradition that goes back several hundred years of interpreting Islamic jurisprudence for a given situation, given a set of facts, that is very, very interpretive.
So it's prudential, we would call it.
Absolutely. And yes, there are extreme interpretations, and so I would point out.
So there's fundamentalist interpretations.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah.
So you have groups like the Taliban or ISIS who are interpreting law, as it were, I would argue, very, very irresponsibly, very violently, very wrongly, even under Islamic jurisprudence. And let's just take one issue, for example. Oftentimes this is raised about the treatment of women. So you have countries like Saudi Arabia, for example, that don't allow women to drive. Their rights are very much limited. When they travel, they have to have a male, either a father or a son or a husband with them. And we know that in Saudi Arabia, women have serious challenges. I would argue, as a Muslim and as a lawyer, by the way, that these are very much in contrary to the tradition of Islam. But for various reasons, mainly cultural in Saudi Arabia, these laws have been instituted, very draconian, very harsh towards the treatment of women. And that's a challenge. And I have worked to educate my fellow Muslims in Saudi Arabia about liberalizing those.
Why haven't you been arrested?
Well, whether it's advocating for Christians in Vietnam or China, as you articulated in the opening, or for the rights of women in Muslim countries, I tried to work with the governments to educate them and to push without challenging, perhaps. And there's some that are
more. No, there's diplomacy involved always.
Yeah.
We appreciate
So you have those examples of countries like Saudi Arabia, like Afghanistan, where women are very much treated negatively, and Islam, I would argue, is used as an excuse to perpetuate that discrimination. On the other hand, you have countries like Indonesia, which, by the way, is the largest Muslim country by population, Pakistan, which is the second largest Muslim country by population, Bangladesh, Turkey, that have all elected popularly women heads of state, and in some cases, like Bangladesh, twice.
Well, let's slow down there.
Yeah.
You're saying something very important that our listeners need to get it. You've just named, what, four countries that are that have the largest percentage of Muslim population,
mm-hmm,
who do not act like the Saudis.
That's correct.
They allow women the freedom to participate in public life, to be elected to office.
Mm-hmm. And to the head of the
state. And so, do we have a distorted view of Islam in this country?
I think so. And to be fair, the responsibility is not only on non-Muslims to learn about the true precepts of Islam, but also for Muslims to work harder to promote what I would argue is mainstream Islam. I just had a long conversation with a Muslim friend in New York yesterday about this very issue. I said, look, the majority of Americans, our fellow Americans, have a misguided view about the truth about Islam, and it's on us to really, those that are mainstream practicing Muslim Americans, to cut through the clutter and to work harder, that much harder, to educate not only people in influence like Dr. Ben Carson or Donald Trump, but also our neighbors and our friends and our colleagues about what Islam is. And polls show, Deal, that Americans who have friends who are Muslim Americans have a much more positive view of Islam, not only because of their mm-hmm. friendship with individual Muslims, but also from their Muslim Americans, maybe not even talking about it, but just seeing the daily lives of Muslim Americans who take their kids to school, who are involved in PTA or soccer coaches and doctors and lawyers in society, that, hey, they're just like us and they have the same challenges and the same goals as we all do.
Well, Sunil, I want to tell you a quick story that I think you'll enjoy, and that is my son Cyprian, whom you've met, I'm sure, somewhere along mm-hmm. the way,
yeah.
is now a senior in high school here in Fairfax. And there's 20% Muslim attendance at this high school.
Mm-hmm.
And there was so much trouble, so much bullying toward the Muslims that they started to seat them at a corner table in the cafeteria. Well, my son demanded to go sit with them.
Good for him.
Because he had a few friends over there, and he felt, and he himself had been bullied earlier in his public school experience.
Awesome.
And so he started sitting with them, and he earned the nickname the Unifier. And now other Anglo kids, non-Muslim kids, have started going over sitting at that table with them. And so that's exactly what you're talking about.
Well, and that is the other issue, Deal, that we need to talk about at some point, and that is, in the end, it's not Muslim versus Christian versus people of the Jewish faith or any other faith. It's really, when it comes down to it, and I don't mean to get too political, but it's really, when it comes down to the challenges in our country that we're facing now is really centered on people of faith versus those that want to eradicate faith in public life. That's why I still feel firmly that people of faith, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, and others need to work together to really counter the ardent secularists in our society who don't want any religious expression, don't want people to identify themselves publicly as a member of any faith. It's really people of faith getting together and working together, because that's where the real challenge lies.
Well, I mean, Ben Carson is an impressive, intelligent, articulate man who has come out of nowhere to gain quite a following in this country. What's going on there? I mean, as you point out in your op-ed, which, by the way, when we come to the break, I'm going to give everyone the information so they can go to the op-ed directly. Our Constitution clearly says there should not be a religious test.
That's right.
For anybody entering politics.
That's right. That's right.
What happened? I mean, what's going on with Ben Carson? What's the mistake?
The mistake is twofold. First, he's not understanding just what you articulated, that the Constitution is very clear on this issue, that there is no religious test in serving in public office, and that the founding fathers, that this was not an accident of history, that the founding fathers discussed this very issue when they ratified the U.S. Constitution. Our country declared our independence, everybody knows, in 1776, but it wasn't until 1787 that the framers drafted the U.S. Constitution, and that extraordinary document was ratified by the states in 1788. So in that time period, the states had very, very active debates on this very issue, and several proponents for a religious test. The exact phrase is that no religious test shall be ever required as a qualification to any or public trust under the United States. So several founders were very concerned about that, and they rightly pointed out, one of them was Henry Abbott of North Carolina, and he said, if they suppose that there be no religious test required, pagans, deists, and Mohammedans might obtain office among us.
Yes, there was a lot of awareness of what they thought of as the Muslim threat, because only a century earlier, the Muslims had gotten all the way to the gates of Vienna.
That's right.
To be defeated,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another delegate from Massachusetts worried that if we didn't have a religious test, a papist or an infidel.
Mm-hmm. Well, that lasted, as you point out, into the Kennedy era.
That's right. That's right. And there was, of course, other groups besides Catholics and Muslims that people were concerned about, and that included Jews and Quakers and other religious denominations within the Christian faith that some of our founding fathers weren't too fond of. But the overwhelming number of delegates, including Baptist preacher John Leland, a Virginian, were in favor of having a ban on religious tests. And he said, if a man merits the confidence of his neighbors in Virginia, let him worship one God, 20 gods, or no God, be he Jew, Turk, pagan, or infidel, he is eligible to any office in the state.
So who said that?
That was John Leland, who was a preacher himself, a Baptist minister himself, but also a delegate from Virginia. And so these discussions were had. They very much contemplated members of the Jewish faith, Catholics, atheists, and Turks or Mohammedans, then what they were referring to as Muslims, as seeking and even securing federal elected office. And that
it's particularly important to note that the delegate from Virginia was speaking from a state that had been the most aggressive about keeping Catholics out.
That's right.
At the beginning.
Yeah, yeah. That's right, and Massachusetts wasn't much better when it came to Catholics.
Well, they obviously lost that battle. The Irish overcame that wall.
That's right. So these discussions were had. We know that Thomas Jefferson had a Quran, read the Quran. The Library of Congress still has that copy of the Quran, and in a fun twist of fate. When the first Muslim American was elected to Congress, Keith Ellison of Minneapolis in 2006, he took his oath of office. And again, it should be pointed out, when you take your oath of office, you're not taking it to the Bible or to the Quran. You're taking it to the Constitution, but you're placing your hand on a book. Some don't place their hand on anything, but if you choose... many placed their hand on a family Bible, and Keith Ellison, and then subsequently Andre Carson, the second Muslim member, Muslim American elected to Congress from Indianapolis, both placed their hand on the very Quran that was owned by Thomas Jefferson. So there is a history.
I'm sure that earned them criticism anyway.
Oh, of course it did. You know, and there were some commenters who said that, you know, they're doing that because they're going to try and secretly impose Sharia on all of us. Some friends said something very curious. They said they should still take their oath of office on the Bible, which just was kind of odd because, as I said, first of all, you're not taking it to the Bible. You're taking it to protect and defend the U.S. Constitution. And my question to those friends was, well, when they're taking their oath of office to protect and defend the U.S. Constitution, don't you want them to swear by something they actually believe in?
Yeah, something that they hold even higher than their than their commitment to the nation. I mean, by tradition, anyone's religious faith has a more important obligation than their citizenship, right?
That's right. And, you know, if you look at the history of this, there have been Supreme Court justices who have taken their oath of office on the Talmud. One justice took his oath of office on the Jewish interpretation of law. So that is
the Talmud.
Yeah, exactly. The Talmud.
And also the Mishnah. Those two books.
That's right. So, and that's just something of preference.
I'm trying to think, if I was elected, I might take Aristotle's Ethics or maybe Madame Bovary. I'm not sure. One of the other. But the symbolism is, you're saying, according to that which I believe in that supersedes even my obligations to my nation, I swear to do this job.
Right. But the final test, really, whether it's serving in the military, serving in federal service, as I did, as you pointed out in the introduction, or serving in elected office, is to protect and defend the U.S. Constitution. That is what's paramount, and that's where the test.
And is there, however, Suhail, one form, or at least a form of fundamentalist Sharia that would make it impossible for someone in good faith to take that oath?
Well, there are those clearly who interpret Islam as not allowing them to serve in, for example, in the military, or to take an oath of office, or to pledge allegiance. I haven't met people like that, but I know they exist. And if that is the case, then obviously I would find it very curious for them to seek elected office and then to say I don't want to.
I doubt very much, at least in this day and time, they'd be elected.
Yeah. But there are people of various faiths that I was just in Israel deal, and I was very interested to learn that there are members of the Knesset, very devout members of the Jewish faith who do not recognize Israel. It's one of those curious.
Oh yeah, as you well know, I've been to the Holy Land many times, including with your friends, and the Knesset is. The opinions there are in no way reflected in the American media, the diversity of opinions.
Yeah. So it's very interesting. So when I asked a friend, I said, how does that work? How can you not recognize the very country that you are a member of an elected body representing? And they said, well, what we've done for those members of the Jewish faith who are elected to the Knesset and who refuse to recognize Israel as state as Israel, and that is that they take an oath not to the to protect Israel per se, but they take an oath to recognize the laws of Israel.
Yeah,
I think I guess it works for the state of Israel. But I have to say, no matter what your faith, if you're an American and you refuse to protect and defend the U.S. Constitution, I would draw the line there and say, sorry, you can't serve in elected office. That's just me.
I'm talking to my friend Suhail Khan, who is a Muslim conservative and a defender of religious liberty, attended Catholic schools as a young man, survived Berkeley, and the University of Iowa Law School, came out a staunch conservative, and obviously represents the cause of American freedom and religious liberty very well around the world. Suhail will be back to talk to you some more right after this short message.
They kill the unborn and then put their body parts up for sale. We must expose this terrible, horrific injustice. Join the protests of Planned Parenthood clinics in Michigan as part of the National Protest of Planned Parenthood, Saturday, October 10th. Find all locations at protestpp.com. That's protestpp.com. Let us all stand up for the sanctity of life.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I am Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, it is often asked if the Eastern churches acknowledge things like Lourdes and Fatima. There is a particular way that the Eastern churches do approach visions and revelations, especially in regard to the Mother of God.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO Ave Maria Radio.
Hi, this is Father John Ricardo, inviting you to join me as we explore some of the deepest questions that arise in our hearts, questions that shape the way we think, the way we speak, and the way we live. For all of these questions, Christ is the answer.
Our individual and corporate relationship with our Lord, our relationship with the church, the precepts of the church, our relationship with the world and the culture that surrounds us. Father John Ricardo discusses these things and more, all from the Catholic perspective, on Christ is the answer. Listen to Christ is the Answer Wednesday evenings at 8, Saturday afternoons at 5, and Sunday mornings at 11 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. He is the image of the invisible God. He points us to our destiny. He reveals the dignity of the human person. He is the one who makes known the Father. Christ is the Answer.
Christ is the Answer is brought to you by the Ave Maria Communications Guild.
With Suhail Khan, longtime friend here in Washington, D.C., and a Muslim American who is presently Director of External Affairs at Microsoft, member of the Conservative Action Project and Senior Fellow at the Institute for Global Engagement, a Christian religious freedom think tank. Let's get back to the issue of Ben Carson. Now, he has backed off from that position. However, he got immediately received a great deal of public support. Did that alarm you?
It did alarm me. It concerns me. It did not surprise me because, again, as we discussed previously, there is a lot of concern, misunderstanding, suspicion when it comes to Islam and Muslims. And so his statements and the support that he's garnered having made those statements is only reflective of, unfortunately, the current state of play when it comes to understanding the reality of Islam and Muslims. And, of course, that's in the backdrop of 9/11 and the subsequent attacks that have occurred on our country and around the globe, unfortunately, in the name of Islam.
And do you think that issue, at least the Carson incident that you mentioned, is dying down, or do you think it will remain an issue through the 2016 election?
I think it will remain an issue. I'm hoping, because I'm an optimist, that this is a teachable moment and that while his comments are very troubling, misguided, that at least it will afford an opportunity for well-meaning people like yourself to talk about this issue and to learn and for folks to really examine the reality of the situation. So that's what I'm hoping. Eventually, I'm confident that as Americans, just as we dealt with the quote-unquote Catholic question in 1960,
right,
the election of President Kennedy, or the Mormon question with the nomination of Mitt Romney in 2012, that we'll embrace the Constitution, we'll embrace our American tradition, and realize that that people of faith, as long as if they love our country, that they that their faith only enhances, their faith tradition only enhances the American experience, and that indeed applies to Muslim Americans as well. So I'm very confident that this conversation will end very well and will end in the American spirit. But in the meantime, the conversation must be had. It's complicated. It's bumpy. I'm not sure how long we'll continue to have to engage on this issue. But, you know.
Here's what I'd like for you to do, Suhail, if you don't mind me just saying this on air.
Sure.
I think the absolutely crucial point you made when I heard you speak yesterday at Americans for Tax Reform is that, and you did this in answer to an intelligent question from a good friend of ours, are both intelligent and well-intentioned question.
Mm-hmm.
You were asked about Sharia, and you said, but there are many forms of Sharia. Well, you just can't throw the word Sharia up and assume that. So I would like for you to write an article. I'd be glad to publish it at the Christian Review. Just which would be entitled something like Don't Assume You Know What Sharia Means, or something like that.
And since
we have listeners who may have tuned in late, I want you to underscore the point you made, because you always hear this conversation stopper, but they have Sharia law.
Right?
And for many people, that's the end of the conversation.
That's right.
But that should actually be the beginning of another conversation.
Absolutely.
And how should that conversation go?
Well, here's how it goes. First of all, what is Sharia? Sharia is a interpretive doctrine of law that is guided and is interpreted using both the Quran and the prophetic tradition of the Muslim prophet Muhammad. And it is, again, as we've already discussed, very interpretive. And so there are some on the fringe, I would argue, who would have very extreme interpretations, who would not vary their interpretation.
You said you'd never met any of them.
I personally have not met them, other than just reading about them in the media. Like you and I both have, are seen on our daily news. But as far as American Muslims, no. American Muslims want what everybody else wants, and that is to put their kids into a decent school, to have a good job, and to get through traffic so they can get to work on time.
But Suhail, you know, just yesterday, you know? We had a Muslim, we think he's a Muslim, go in and kill 13 college students in Oregon. I mean, this kind of thing just keeps people, if not suspicious, actually alienated from the Muslim tradition.
Sure.
Well, I mean, I know that puts you in an awkward position, but somebody has to stand up and say, "Look, it's not what you know. This doesn't mean what you think it means."
Right. So when it comes to that, when it comes to these quote unquote homegrown terrorists who are, you know, becoming radicalized and taking matters in their own hands and going and killing innocents, what's happening is contrary to the tradition of Islam. That is wrong. Murder is murder. Murder is prohibited in Islam. And these people, mostly young people, are very much misguided. This is something that has been condemned repeatedly by mainstream Muslim organizations, by mainstream Muslim scholars. Unfortunately, those condemnations are not making it into the mainstream media. We don't hear about it and see it. What I tell my Muslim American friends, particularly those that are imams and other community leaders, that they need to do it again and again and again and louder. But what is also happening that you don't see behind the scenes is that Muslim clerics particularly and community leaders are working very closely with law enforcement to counter this radicalization. For years we were really kind of chasing after something that wasn't happening, and the myth was that we had Muslim clerics who were preaching violence out of the pulpit and radicalizing their followers. That wasn't really what was happening. What we now find is the reality is that there are individuals mainly overseas who are reaching through the internet and radicalizing individuals who have their own problems, mental health issues, unemployment, etc., and taking advantage of them just as a child predator would do, to radicalize them and then to push them out into engaging in violence against innocents. And so people that have a knowledge of Islamic theology, who know their communities and are working hand in glove with those that understand the internet and technology, are working to really stop this radicalization. And the majority of plots that have been foiled in recent years have been foiled with the help of Muslim Americans. Do we need to do more? Absolutely. Is this an ongoing challenge? It absolutely is. This is something that, unfortunately, is a phenomenon that we have to just keep working on and be smart about. But this is what's happening, and our fellow Americans need to know that community leaders are this is something that they're working very diligently to meet this challenge and to stop people from heading down the path of radicalization. And the latest issue, of course, is now we have people that are leaving our country and going to places like Syria and Iraq and becoming radicalized and being recruited there. And
I'm so glad you brought that up, Suhail.
Absolutely.
I read about, most recently, a British journalist got himself embedded with ISIS for about a month.
Wow.
And came back and said it. It said, you know, it's an American that was leading this particular group that he, blonde, blue-eyed American.
Yeah.
And of course, you hear a lot about the British going there, upper middle class, and upper class Americans.
Yeah.
Now, what is the attraction of going over there and belonging to a group that's beheading Coptic Christians on the beach of the Mediterranean?
Yeah, or enslaving people, and absolutely.
What's the attraction?
It's hard to understand. The only way I've really can explain that is, you know, again, these are society's misfits. Without exception, I find that these are people that are having trouble in their personal lives. They're not getting along with their parents. They're not having consistent employment. They're not, they don't have girlfriends or wives. You know, just the the shooter yesterday in Oregon, we understand that he was having trouble dating and was not getting along with friends or neighbors or family members. These are people that have personal issues, and the recruiters, the extremist recruiters from ISIS and other organizations are taking advantage of that. And while the vast majority of Muslim Americans are not responding to this recruitment, they just need one in a thousand or whatever the numbers might be for some misfit who says, I'm just not fitting in. And then somebody says, well, why don't you come to Syria where you can be part of a group, and we're engaged in a struggle that's bigger than all of us, and you can be a part of it. And that message, unfortunately, again, while the vast majority are rejecting that, there are individuals who are unfortunately susceptible to that type of siren's call, and we as Americans of all faiths need to work diligently to really fight that and to prevent that type of recruitment.
But you talk about the communities of Muslims in America who are upset and speaking out against these kinds of tragic events. It seems to me that the majority of Americans don't hear that. They don't hear that protest.
Yeah, that's right.
What's going on in that we're not hearing that?
I'm not sure. For many years after 9/11, I was pushing Muslim American organizations, scholars particularly, to get their condemnations, particularly those that are based and rooted in Islamic theology, to get those out on the internet, to make much more vocal, much more than just sending out a press release. That was happening, but then I was finding that the press wasn't covering it. And so then, actually working with the then Archbishop of D.C., Theodore McCarrick, a group of Muslims joined by rabbis and Theodore McCarrick and other Christian leaders went to the press club and did an event where a Muslim scholars, over 500 of them, there is a Council of Muslim Scholars in the United States that governs Muslim life in the United States. They issued a very comprehensive religious decree, also known as a fatwa, condemning terrorism, condemning religious extremism, condemning violence in the name of religion against both Muslims and non-Muslims. And they went to the press club, where you traditionally think in Washington, D.C., you'll get some press coverage. And there was nary a headline or a...
Right. I've been here too long. I understand completely. Our listeners, though, may want to know, is there a website, is there some place that they can go to regularly and be more informed about Muslim opinion?
There are several. The one that I think would be very good on these types of issues, and an organization that has done a very good job of working with law enforcement and community organizations to really meet this extremist narrative, is the Muslim Public Affairs Council, MPAC.
What's their website?
I believe it's MPAC, MPAC.org. And they're
spell that one more time.
MPAC.org.
Well, that's easy. MPAC.org.
Yep, MPAC, okay. Muslim Public Affairs Council, and they're an organization that has been doing great work on a host of issues.
So they would have responded to this Oregon killing and any other.
I haven't checked if they've responded to the Oregon killing.
I don't know if they've confirmed for sure that this fellow was motivated by that, but that was.
Yeah, mentioning is the first I've heard of that. So.
Well, he had the victims stand up and declare their religion, and if they were Christian, they shot him.
He was asking for Christians. I heard that part, but
I'm not saying that it's been confirmed. I'm just saying that's potential. And, I've been talking, I've done interviews on this show with other experts in Islam, such as Bob Riley, mm-hmm. who is thought of, because of some of his books, as anti-Islam. He's not in the least. In fact, he's helped to create a coalition of Muslim scholars to work together just in the way that you're talking about and challenge Islamic fundamentalism. And also getting in more, making more visible the Muslim scholars and leaders who are in, you know, in despair over what's, you know, what's happened to their faith.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, that is, that's an effort, and they're, the Muslim American community is definitely looking for better ways to get that message out, to educate fellow Muslim Americans. One of the challenges that we have deal is that there's no central authority in Islam. There's no Muslim pope. There is no, you know, one central figure who's in charge, as it were.
Well, maybe that's so, good, because the guy that would be in charge is probably the Ayatollah Khomeini, right?
Well, see, but there you have different, that's of the Shia tradition, right, which is a minority tradition within Islam. The majority of Muslims, you know, over 80%+ are of the Sunni tradition. And then you have followers of the Shia tradition, which are predominantly in countries like Iran and Iraq, some in Yemen and some in Pakistan. But the majority of Muslim followers of the over 57+ Muslim majority countries are, in fact, Sunni.
Well, Suhail, why don't you run for that office?
Well,
you know,
again, there's...
I mean, can't we create a kind of Islam diplomat or ambassador to the world or something? I think you'd be good for that.
Well, it's much... I appreciate that deal, but, you know, it's much like the Protestant, in the Protestant tradition. Each, you know, each...
you could be the Islamic Billy Graham. You know, they have their unofficial popes.
There are, well, you know, on a more serious note, there are folks who have emerged. There's an imam named Suhaib Webb, S-U-H-A-I-B, last name Webb, W-E-B-B, who is a young Islamic scholar, trained, born and raised, first of all, in Oklahoma.
I should have him on the show. Remind me to get that information from you.
I will help you with that. He lives here in Washington, D.C. He's Oklahoma, born and bred, born a Protestant Christian, converted to Islam as a teenager, and then learned at Al-Azhar University, which is in Cairo, one of the oldest universities
in the world. Yeah, one of the great, great universities in the West.
Fluent in Arabic, in traditional classical, what's known as Fusha Arabic, and, you know, has his training in the classic tradition, but also very much an American. And he is working to build a cadre of young Islamic scholars who are very much in the American tradition. And I'll give you an example of some of the things that he and other imams have been involved with that are in the mainstream Islamic American Islamic tradition. Interest, the giving and taking of interest in Islam, is strictly prohibited.
As it used to be in Christianity.
Correct, correct.
Yeah.
And the reason for that, both in Christianity and Islam, is that in traditional society, those that had the money, we didn't want, our early followers of Christianity and Islam didn't want them to take advantage of young people, or of poor people, I should say, by charging them exorbitant interest, etc. And so my parents, when they finished college and scraped, after we lived in apartments growing up, scraped together to buy their first home in California in the 70s, they saved cash, and they borrowed some cash from friends, and they bought our first family home with cash.
Wow. You
know? Yeah, because they, as followers of Islam, you know, they looked at the rules and Islam.
The real estate and the banks don't like that.
They don't
like it when you have cash.
Right, and it makes it very difficult. So the Islamic scholars in the United States, over 500 of them, got together, I believe this was in the late 80s, and said, okay, let's take a look at this. Islam says you can't give and take interest, period. But let's dive a little deeper into this. Why can't people give and take interest? People go to their local bank and get a mortgage to buy their home? No, it's quite the opposite. The bank, generally speaking, is enabling a young couple or an individual to buy a family home so they can provide for their family. So this is a good thing. We want to encourage that. We want to encourage home ownership. So these Muslim scholars, using Sharia, law, but also taking into consideration the surrounding circumstances of American Muslims, the current laws when it comes to banking and home mortgages, etc. They interpreted that tradition, the purpose behind the tradition, and issued a religious decree, a fatwa, and said, if an American Muslim individual or family wants to buy their family home, this is not to become a slumlord or to become Donald Trump or whomever else, but if you want to buy a family home, it's perfectly consistent with Islamic tradition, Sharia law, to buy a home using a conventional home mortgage.
And again, this is Sharia as interpreted
right
in a liberal
American
tradition.
Liberal tradition.
And I don't mean by liberal in the bad sense, just
free
and allowing freedom.
Exactly, promoting freedom. And so that's not just unique to the United States. We've seen now in UAE, for example, they had their first Muslim fighter pilot, and so Saudi Arabia next door doesn't allow women to drive, and UAE has a fighter pilot that's flying, in the latest American technology. And so there is, I would say, as a Muslim and as a lawyer, there is a great tradition of interpretation. What we need to encourage is for that, quote, lowercase l, liberal interpretation of Islamic law. And that is what's happening not only in the United States but around the globe. What we hear about, unfortunately, is those extreme cases that we all need to join together in combating and fighting of extremist interpretation where,
by the way, Suhail, this
badly, etc.
The studios of Ave Maria Radio, which we're on, is in Michigan, near Dearborn, not too far from Dearborn, where I think most of Muslim—that's the largest group of Muslim Americans in the United States. Isn't that correct?
That's right. It's the largest concentration of Muslim Americans in the United States in Dearborn. Largest concentration of Arabs also, because as you know, not all Arabs are Muslim and not all Muslims are Arab. The second largest, just because we're talking trivia here, is Paterson, New Jersey.
Really?
Yeah, and I wouldn't be surprised if Northern Virginia is in the top five.
Well, if my son's high school in Fairfax, Virginia, which is 3,000-something students, has 20% Muslim students, that's pretty high.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, New York has a large concentration, and for the first time, the Muslim holidays are now state holidays, or citywide, I believe, are holidays in New York.
What I want to do, we've got a few minutes left, Suhail, and I want to tell people where they can find your excellent op-ed.
Well, thank you.
And it's entitled, Thanks to Our Founding Fathers, Even a Muslim Can Become President. Where I found it at the rare.usa website.
Well,
is that the best place to find it?
You can find it at Rare, yeah. And if, funny enough, it was republished on Huffington Post with a different title, and that was All Faiths Are American.
Good. Well, let's give that because that's easier to find. HuffPo.com.
Yep.
All Faiths Are American.
Just look up Suhail Khan. Yeah.
Suhail Khan, and that's for those who are not fluent in such names, that's spelled S-U-H-A-I-L. Suhail.
Hale. H-A-N, yep.
Yeah, and then Khan is K-H-A-N.
That's right. And that piece articulates what our founding fathers discussed and decided when it came to placing a ban on religious tests in the U.S. Constitution. I published a previous piece last week in The Guardian, which talks about some of the more political issues related to this controversy, and that is, not to be too venal, Muslim Americans, of which there are about 6 to 8 million Muslims in the country, and as we just discussed, and while not a big population by numbers, but in big concentrations in certain key states and certain key swing states, including Michigan, Ohio, Florida, and those Muslim Americans in 2000, just 15 short years ago, voted overwhelmingly conservative because Muslim Americans are small business owners, they're doctors, they're businessmen, they have a very high level education, they're pro-life, they're pro-family, they support business and low taxes. They voted overwhelmingly. Most measures put it around 76% for George W.
Wow.
George W. was very good in his
action. He did a good job at Muslim outreach that year.
That's right. He went to a mosque. The candidate.
No, I'm saying you did.
Well, get all the credit.
Because I know you were right at the top of that. Suhail Khan, I really appreciate your being a guest today on Church and Culture, and hope you'll come back.
Absolutely.
And thanks for all you do. And for those of you who are listening, please join us again on Church and Culture on this day at this time. Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about Church and Culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.
The Ave Maria Communications Guild invites you to activate your faith. St. Edith Sinlavonia invites you to experience Father Leo Paddlinghug's Saturday, October 10th, as he presents Savor the Faith with your family. Father Leo is the host of Grace Before Meals and will include a cooking demonstration as he shares the importance of praying and eating together. Reserve your place by calling 734-464-1222. The Capuchin Friars will be hosting a Family Day open house in honor of the Year of Consecrated Life, Sunday, October 11th. Come and visit the Capuchin Ministries on Detroit's East Side. Explore the Solanas Casey Center, the Capuchin Soup Kitchen's Meldrum site, and more. Activities are planned for the whole family. For more information about this free event, call 313-579-2100. You can find many more events and enter your own events at our website, AveMariaRadio.net. To become a member of the Guild, call 877-288-1077.
The following is a message brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan.
In the Battle of Jericho, God commanded that the Jewish people process with trumpets, priests, and the Ark of the Covenant around the city that they might defeat it. It may seem beyond belief that a procession of worship and praise could bring down an enemy city's walls, but that's what we are told happened in Jericho. If obedient worship of God could destroy the strongholds of Jericho, can it not do the same for the strongholds we face? We're in a battle for souls, and worship becomes a powerful weapon in our hands. It may not be visible like a sword, and we may never see walls falling down like at Jericho, but worship unleashes God's divine power that overcomes our spiritual enemies. To learn more about how God leads us into the victory of salvation in Scripture, visit the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan on Facebook or at cbsmich.org.
Hi, Deacon Tom here with a reminder that Ave Maria Radio has some terrific gift ideas for you. Books by our hosts and our guests, recordings on CD, and our new Wi-Fi radios so you can listen to Catholic radio anywhere in the world, anytime you want, as long as you have a Wi-Fi connection. Just go to our website and click the word store in the navigation bar at the top of the page. It's an easy way to shop, and you can help Catholic radio at the same time. The website can be found at avemariaradio.net.
On the next Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
We'll keep you closely connected to the faith with the latest from Rome, the front lines of the pro-life movement, and we'll also take a look at other crucial issues facing you and your family in our one Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church.
Catholic Connection, weekday mornings at 8 a.m. on 990 WDEO.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. Ave Maria Radio's upcoming conference, Cultural Madness and Catholic Sanity, is not just about the state of the world, but about the state of our souls. It's about seeking holiness and becoming the saints Christ has called us to be. When Jesus called me to himself, he called me to be conformed to his life. Likewise, St. Paul writes, to not be conformed to this world, but to be transformed through the renewing of our minds. Worldliness, or being squeezed into the mold of this world, or adopting the priorities of money, sex, and power rather than the kingdom of God, has been a constant challenge to Christians. We'll take a hard look at how American culture seduces us and how the Spirit of God has given us the resources to resist and become the saints we are called to be. So